So typically the day starts around 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, lovely.
No, I don't know what to do with myself. I'll probably go for a coffee, maybe have some breakfast.
Yeah, you got to have all this extra time in your hands.
You're listening to the Office Anywhere podcast, a show that inspires you to live on purpose and create meaningful change for yourself and those you care about. My name is Peter Fritz, and I'm a writer, designer, father of three, and outdoor adventure lover, best known for my ideas around remote work, freelancing, side projects, and personal reinvention. I share stories and strategies that help you find your path, climb your mountain, and create a life you can be proud of. Sometimes I have guests on the show, and other times, well, it's just you and me. To check out previous episodes, go to officeanywhere.co/podcast.
One thing I love to do is ponder what ifs. Like, what if back in the spring of 96, I'd have found a parking spot at the back of Angelucci's instead of having to park on the pavement? My dashing good looks wouldn't have attracted the attention of ex-wife number two, who was dining al fresco only metres away and in see-through pants with a G-string, I would later discover. And what if I hadn't succumbed to her charms literally just 24 hours after splitting from number one? In fact, I was there celebrating the fact that my relationship had finally ended with number one, and there I was getting ready to hook up with number two. But if I hadn't succumbed to her charms so quickly, then I wouldn't have gone on to marry her, nor produce two beautiful daughters before finally suffering an emotionally and financially crippling divorce. And what if said ex hadn't destroyed our relationship with the family accountants? Well, then I wouldn't have met wife number three at the new firm. I also wouldn't have survived my midlife crisis, paid off my debts, nor had our delightful son, Tommy. Instead, I'd be living like my noughties role model, George Clooney, minus the wealth, the fame, and the age-defying looks. I might even be dead. And what if I hadn't stumbled across a copywriter in New York called Laura Belgrave? Well, I wouldn't be having this conversation today. Laura did three important things for me. Number one, she taught me how to be a more natural and engaging writer. Two, she pushed me to invest in Marie Forleo's excellent B School. And three, probably the most important, she introduced me to the disgustingly talented speaker, trainer, writer, and thinker, Matthew Kimberley, my guest today. Incidentally, Matthew can claim one of my other what-ifs too. That's because it was only after a full year of his cajoling, pushing, and encouragement that I finally completed the design and launch of my first course called Escape the Office. Trouble is, the course teaches students how to convince their boss to let them work remotely, and it launched just after the coronavirus forced them to work from home. Bugger. But the good news is, my course will still be there when everyone's told to return to their concrete places of water cooler worship, so I should rake it in by then, I reckon. Plus, I've almost finished my second course, and I know that wouldn't have happened without Matthew's help with the first. So if I hadn't met Matthew, I'd be on my fourth year of blogging without a product to sell. Now, let me give you the official intro. And if I would, I'd put on a Pommy accent, but I'm in front of a real Pom, so I'd probably screw it up. Matthew Kimberley is quite simply a sales training extraordinaire. He's enjoyed and suffered through a veritable buffet of careers in half a dozen countries. He's taught French to rich kids in Kuala Lumpur, served whiskey in Brussels, and taught English through theatre in Italy. In 2007, he founded a tech recruitment company in Belgium, which he grew to millions in revenue before taking on the top job at the Book Yourself Solid School of Coach Training, which you've probably heard of. He later went on to found the School for Selling, and he is the creator of the Single Malt Mastermind and the Principles of Professional Persuasion. Today, from his Bond-style lair on the sunny island of Malta, he works with companies from around the world to help them achieve remarkably better results. And I do love this. Glamour magazine described him as the tough love business guru, which I reckon sums him up perfectly. And so it's time to bring on the man who delivered the kick up the ass that I so desperately needed last year, Matthew Kimberley. Matthew, welcome.
In the history of introductions, Peter, that's the greatest I have ever heard.
A ringing endorsement from the man himself. Well, I took great care in assembling that because I wanted it to be fitting for the person on the other end of this microphone. And I have to say that the main subject of our discussion today, this book that you've released recently, had a phenomenal impact on me already, which is saying something because I've read a lot of books. And it's the reason that I invited you to come. After I read that, I mean, I think I sent you a message on Twitter or something as I was only a few pages in, and already I was saying the book was awesome. I could just tell straight away because I was thinking about this before we started this conversation today. I wanted to think of some of the top takeaways from your book. And the thing I love about your book is The top takeaways happened right in the beginning, and everything else in the book augmented that. You know, I can be terribly impatient. I love Blinkist, and I love, you know, shortened versions of things just to get to the point. And like Seth Godin said, and I'm rambling here, which is going against what I'm trying to convey, he said most books can be 20 pages long, but publishers need them to be 200 pages long. And this is what I loved about your book, is you got to the point, the crux of it, very early, and then the rest added to it and brought life to it. So, you know,
I'm glad you said that, Peter. Most people like the book, at least most people you hear from like the book. And occasionally you'll see a review or read a review that says, you know, started strong and, no pun intended, petered off. And I'm glad that you recognize that I didn't have much to say. Right. I don't know about you, but I've read a ton of books, which are the first chapter is I'm going to tell you what you're going to read in the rest of the book. Right. That's kind of de rigueur. That's necessary for nonfiction books today. It seems the first introductory chapter tells you exactly what's about to follow. It's like the three part speech formula.
Yes.
Tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them. Tell them what you told them. Mm. And I didn't know what I was doing, and I had nobody to guide me, you know, when I was writing it. So I said, well, what do I want to say? I want to say these things. Now, can we drill that point home?
Yes.
So I'm glad you recognize that, Peter. Thank you.
It is so unusual and it's so refreshing. It truly is. You know, I'll get to this a little bit later on, but, you know, I got some feedback from one of my favorite writers in all the world that kind of supports this notion of keeping things concise, making things approachable. A couple of years ago, a friend of mine asked me to edit a book that he'd written, and the book was brilliant. The subject matter was brilliant. And it was something which I felt compelled to help him release out into the world, but the way he wrote it was so laborious. It was a major task just to get through it. I mean, as an old mentor of mine said, don't say in 30 words what you can say in 10. This guy was taking 100 words to say what you could say in 3, and it was so frustrating. The whole thing was full of red, and I finally sent it back to him, and he rang me up, and his first word, he's a very nice, very polite Christian guy. The first word he said was, fuck. I can't believe you think this book is so wrong. And I said, John, this thing is just too bloody hard to read. I mean, a lot of people need to read this book, but you're making them go through enormous obstacles just to consume it. He said, well, I want them to earn the right for this knowledge. And I thought, you got completely the wrong idea. If you want people to earn the right to read your book, then you're not going to sell any books.
Yeah, I think if people give you $10 or $20 or whatever it is, that's the trade, right?
Exactly.
Here's $20. Now that's, you've earned it. Congratulations.
Exactly.
Now, whether you enjoy it or not is up to the writer, I think.
That's right. That's right. Now, your book called Get a Fucking Grip, How to Get Your Life Back on Track. Despite the Mark Manson style title, this book is truly unique. And I've got to ask you about that in a minute. There is so much to love about the advice it offers, but particularly, as I mentioned, the way you dispense it. So we're going to talk a bit more about that later on and why everyone should buy at least five copies like I did. And I plan to buy more of them. And I want to give 3 away after this, and then I'm going to buy some more as well. So, but first I want to learn about how you were created. You know, not biologically, unless you want to share that. That's up to you. I don't know. Maybe you have pictures. But how you came to be who you are, you know, what was young Matthew like? Where did you grow up? What were your parents like? And what did you want to be when you grew up, assuming that you have?
1979, Mum and Dad were on vacation in Paris, France.
Oh, you don't need to say anymore.
There you go.
The next question.
You wanted that? There you go. Brought up in a very supportive, loving, religious household in the south of England. My dad was a priest. My mum was a nurse. I went to boarding school aged 11. My choice. I said, I want to go.
Really?
My parents said, my parents said, I'm not sure. I was like, I'd been to visit for something. They had a theater and I loved the performing arts, and they had a theater and I went to watch a show or two at this particular location, which was set in 30 acres of British countryside.
Wow.
It was, you know, fantastic. And my parents were like, well, we don't have any money and, we don't want you to leave home aged 11. And so we got a scholarship. Like most of the kids in the school had a scholarship, and ended up indulging myself in the performing arts and creative writing and music and things like that for between the ages of 11 and 18. So those were really formative years. I knew when I was 5 or 6, I wanted to be a punk. growing up in the 80s in the UK, punks were a big, important part of our cultural heritage. You know, it was all safety pins and mohawks and leather jackets. And I idolized these guys. And I think it was, there was something about the iconoclasm about it, something about the, you know, not
middle finger up to the establishment.
The man. Exactly right. Yeah. And that was, I think that kind of stuck with me. I started earning money as about 14, 15 year old when I would be a street performer. I'd go out and juggle. One of my teachers at school had taught me how to juggle. I took that to the streets and started to realize I could become in control of my own income. And that made me quite restless. So while all my friends aged 18 were applying to university, I went to Malaysia and I tried to leave school age 16. I said I wanted to be a barman.
How old were you when you went to Malaysia?
18.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay.
No. When I was 16, I tried to leave school. I said to my parents, I finished my mandatory education here in the UK. I'm going to go and travel Europe. Mm-hmm. I could get bar work. I could do casual work around Europe. And they were like, well, we can't force you to go back to school. But eventually they did. They gave me a couple of weeks. They roped in some of my teachers. And I'm glad they did, because when I finally went to complete my studies, higher education in the UK is age 17 and 18. We call them the A-levels, pre-university work. I was there because I'd made the choice, or at least I believed that I had the choice. And I was like, yeah, I could do this now because I choose to be here. So those were fulfilling years, studied French and German and Italian and Spanish, and then went to Malaysia when I was 18 and enjoyed the Far East enormously, but hated being broke. I mean, I didn't have a pot to piss in. I was working in a private school with some of the wealthiest kids in the whole of Asia. Have you seen Crazy Rich Asians, the movie?
Yeah, I love it.
Those kids,
right,
I mean, literally
gotcha.
those kids. Yeah. And I was, you know, I was on $100 a month in pocket money and accommodation and food.
Bloody
so
hell.
That was frustrating. I left there. I said, now I want to earn some money. So I think I went to work with a law firm. My godfather was it? Did I go to work with a law firm? Yeah, I think I went to work with a law firm. My godfather was a barrister and a criminal magistrate and a criminal lawyer. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's the route to the cash, but got restless very quickly. Ended up in Italy teaching English and showing tourists how to ski and things like that. And eventually ended up in Belgium, just you know, one place after another, ended up in Belgium. And settled really there, started a company, got married, had a kid, and then moved to Malta a decade ago. So that's been my story.
What a renaissance man.
Right. I've just turned 40 this last weekend, so I'm anticipating a really interesting midlife crisis in the near future.
Well, if you haven't had one, you're well overdue. Mind you, 40 is the new 30,
right.
So maybe you should wait another 10 years. When you're 50.
I can't wait another 10 years. We're going to have to fabricate some form of a midlife crisis. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, if you don't have financial troubles or relationship problems, then you're going to have to come up with something else. Maybe a terminal disease or something?
Well, I was thinking more something positive, perhaps. Maybe
a positive midlife crisis.
Dangerous hobby or questionable tattoos or you know, taking a lover or something like that.
Yeah,
there's a thousand things I could do.
That would be an interesting spin on it, actually, to choose to have a midlife crisis based on having a very good life.
I can't wait. Well, you know, never been one to shy away from self-sabotage.
Neither have I. Hey, speaking about punk rockers, have you read Billy Idol's book?
I have not.
It is brilliant. I don't know why I bought it. Something must have attracted me to it. I do like autobiographies, but I don't read a lot of them. And it's a rollicking ride. Is it Whiplash Smile? I don't know what it's called. It's called something after one of his songs. But it is when you started talking about how you wanted to be a punk rocker and what it meant to you, read the book. It's funny.
I've just taken
a note. It's scary, man. He should have died about 100 times, that guy. I'm surprised he made it through. So something else you touched on there too, which is kind of one of the first questions I wanted to ask you, is I think that most entrepreneurial types, most ruckus makers, as Seth Godin calls them, they have this burning desire from a very young age to be autonomous, to steer their own ship and control their own destiny. And often it starts with discovering how to make money. I was very much the same. I was making money from the age of 8, had my first job when I was 14, always figuring out how to do things that could make me extra money and buy me the stuff I wanted, drum kit, motorbike, camera gear, that sort of stuff. So I suspect that, you know, you probably were afflicted by this from a young age too with the juggling. So was that what sort of kicked it off for you? Was it, did you have other people in your life who, you know, you saw had independent, autonomous lives and you thought, I want to be like that? How did it happen for you?
Yeah, I don't think so. You know, I'm certainly the black sheep in the family. My parents and my sibling brother are different to me in mm-hmm. that respect. My mum's very creative. My dad's very consistent, very happy man. I've always felt a little bit restless, mm-hmm. like just from day one, from when I tried to run away from home age six, but, you know, didn't. My parents indulged it until I got to the road and then, you know, I had to cross the road on my own and things like that. So there's always been this restlessness, always this thirst for adventure. And I think, people looking at my motivation, I spend a lot of time in rooms with incredibly ambitious, incredibly financially successful people who are building companies with their eye on 8 or 9 figures in revenue, on sales, on growth, on scale. And although I live in that world, I'm not really of that world. I was speaking at an event in San Diego and we had a dinner and I found myself saying, I think I'm a creative trapped in an entrepreneur's body. Like just by default, I have fallen into this world of entrepreneurship. And what I have struggled with up until recently, when I've kind of made peace with it, I think, is why does my ambition not match the ambition of my peers? Why do I not want an 8-figure company? Why mm-hmm. do I not want a team around me? Why do I value lifestyle now over lifestyle in the future? Not that the two are necessarily mutually exclusive.
But one that you can at least control now, the other one is a potential promise that may not eventuate.
Possibly. But I've always put, like, you know, we talk about the glass ceiling and we talk about self, we cap ourselves. And I felt I do to a certain degree. I mentioned self-sabotage earlier. That was only slightly tongue-in-cheek. Mm-hmm. But, and there's a thousand, I'm sure a psychologist or even a psychiatrist would have an absolute field day on me. But certainly my motivation is not financial. Mm-hmm. I used to think it was. I said when I started my recruitment company age 27, I'll be retired by 35. Mm-hmm. And the reason I wanted that is because I didn't want to be making money in a recruitment company, right? I wanted to be a barman and work in bars all around Europe and not be constrained by anything. So for me, my motivation now, and I've made peace with the fact that as long as my kids are fed, as long as my retirement is taken care of, and these are luxuries, I know. I mean, I must sound like a real brat to some people.
No.
But my bar there is much lower than many of my peers and many of my contemporaries. You know, mm-hmm. my kids are fed and I'm insured against disaster mm-hmm. and I can jump on a plane and go pretty much anywhere without thinking about the financial burden, mm-hmm. then I'm set. And if that's also true in 10 years, then I'd be set even more. Maybe it's not true in 10 years. You know, I don't think I could stop working today, although I have taken long periods of my life, including 7 months last year when I didn't work.
Wow.
Yeah, because of this restlessness and time for change and time to mix things up. So my motivation has definitely been around being able to fill a space that I've defined rather than filling my bank balance. But I've recognized from a young age, if I wanted to, my friends would say, let's go up to London and get drunk at Trafalgar Square, which was, you know, 90 minutes on the train from me. That was going to cost me 30 or 40 pounds. Which when you're 14 years old, if you want to get home safely, when you're 14 years old is a lot of money, but I could earn it in an hour and a half by going and doing some juggling. So my motivation to do the work was always to experience the rewards.
Yep. Not just to accumulate money for money's sake.
Correct.
Yeah, I relate to everything that you've said there. It's so ironic how often the guests that I seem to be fortunate enough to invite onto the show have such similar backstories to me. I mean, Mary Rogers, who I just told you I spent 3 hours with a couple of days ago, our lives mirrored each other's almost to the year. Started work at 14, got married at 19, did this, got divorced, did this kind of job. It was incredible how often, and all the stuff you just said there, I relate so much to all of that. I too believe that I'm a creative trapped inside an entrepreneur's body. And when I was in senior school, I was told by the drama teacher that I needed to be an actor, that this is what I should be doing. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. But again, like a lot of us when we're young and full of hormones and not many brains, I succumbed to shiny gold things and I wanted lots of money because I believed it would give me that feeling of success and, you know, living the life and, you know, living large. And I made lots of money and I lost lots of money. And I can definitely attribute my happiest times, or I know that my happiest times had nothing to do with how much money I had. And that's a cliche, and everybody who's made lots of money will tell you that. But it's so true, isn't it? Often we just don't recognize these things until we've experienced them, that the stuff that makes you happy is making sure your kids are taken care of, that you have a creative outlet, that you can serve people in some unique way where they really want you because of how you do stuff. And there's not much else that you really need.
And I think I agree with you 100%. And I would add that one, I even got a keynote on this. I believe that money makes a lot of those things possible. You know, so it's, the happiest times of my life also have had nothing to do with money. But the most stressed periods of my life have been alleviated by not having to worry about money as well.
No, you're very right.
My youngest kid was in intensive care for 7 weeks after he was born, and we ended up in hospital away from home in a foreign country we were living in Malta. We had to fly to London because the heart surgeon wasn't available in Malta. So we ended up living in a rented room for 3 months in London where neither myself nor my wife could work, and it was a massive period of stress, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have to worry about money, and that was a relief. You know, my wife a few years ago, several long time ago, was a working lawyer, and she got, one of her clients was dodgy as all hell. She got embroiled in a situation which required her to stop working, required her to hire a lawyer. And of course, lawyers are really expensive. And you know what helps with that?
Money.
Right? So even during these incredibly stressful periods, not having to worry about money. And I think we risk buying into, Jeff Goins talks a lot about this, we risk buying into the starving artist cliche if we say, I don't need money. I absolutely recognize the need for money, but not at any cost.
Yeah,
which is why when I quit my recruitment company, which would have possibly retired me by the age of 35, I felt freedom like I'd never felt before, even though my earnings went from something to nothing.
Yeah.
Because I believed then, I changed my relationship with money. I believed, like, properly. I always had it's a resource out there for the getting mentality. Mm-hmm. But I saw what volume or what scale that was possible through recruitment. And it's like you adapt to, I use a phrase that's been overused recently, a new normal.
Yeah.
If your normal is everyone in this town earns 20K a year, then minute you start earning 50K a year, that becomes your new normal.
Yeah.
And your expectation and your blinkers are open. Mm. So I'm a big fan of raising the normal value. That doesn't hurt, because what are we doing? We're just expanding our thinking and expanding our experience. But it's possible to do both. Living proof, me, my friends, you, many other people, it's possible to have both, and you don't have to cap your ambitions. But I think it's important to, I sound really much more woo-woo than I would like now, but, you know, a little bit of living in the present has served me very well.
Yeah, nothing woo-woo about that. And there's a couple of points in your book that really stuck out for me about things like lowering your expectations. And this always, as you've just pointed out, has to be tempered with an understanding of where you're at and what order your house is in, because, you know, they reckon that beyond $70,000 a year, any more money doesn't make you much happier, because chances are that's taking care of most of your basic needs. And look, honestly, I've been through enormous stress too. I mean, when I had five houses and then went down to zero and ended up with 140 grand in debt, that was a big turnaround for me. You know, I had big plans and there was all sorts of wonderful stuff I was going to do, and I was going to retire early too. The whole thing turned to shit and I lost it all. So I have to say now that, you know, it's taken me a good 10 years to dig myself out of that crap and build up an asset base again and have, you know, a house to live in and a couple of others, and have, you know, financial security there for the future. And so it's easy for me to sit here now and say that money doesn't matter that much. But I guess what I mean is that I'm quite happy now to drive a secondhand Japanese four-wheel drive instead of the new Mercedes-Benz that I used to have. I'm happy to have a little.
I've gone car free recently.
I figured
it is better. Just Uber is just everywhere. I can order a car when I need one, which isn't very often. Living on a rock, 20 miles by 10, with a tap of a button.
Yeah,
so my wife still has a car for ferrying the kids. I said that sound. We still have a car for ferrying the kids around.
Yeah,
but we don't need two cars, and we don't. Yeah, right. And we don't need two cars, and I don't need one ever, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my trouble is I'm afflicted with a love of cars. I mean, I've been around cars. I started driving when I was 8 years old. I worked for a car magazine for years. I drove my first Lamborghini when I was 18, not mine. But, you know, I've always loved cars. So I have the four-wheel drive because we go in the desert. We go up in the high country. We go camping and stuff. And I have a little MX-5 sports car because I need something to tear around, you know, mountain roads when I need
two-seater,
to do that.
Two-seater, right, the MX-5?
Two-seater, me and my boy, me and my son.
There we go.
Yeah,
there we go.
Perfect. And it's going to be his when he's older. But he's not getting it for free. He's going to buy it. But he's going to get it at a significant discount.
Soft top convertible?
Yes. Yeah, and it's lowered. It's got all sorts of cool stuff on it to make it handle better and everything. I love it. And, you know, it's a hell of a lot cheaper than a Porsche. You know, it cost me $22,000 with 10,000 Ks on it. And a brand new one of those is 50 and a Porsche is 150. So, I figure it's a cheap indulgence. And listen, I want to get to another question.
There's still a bit of my thinking, which, and I have to check myself, because around here, you know, we've got people with silly money and I do see the cars that cost more than my house. And I still say, that's stupid. And then the other voice in my head says, yeah, but it's only because you can't afford it.
Yeah.
Well, that's fair enough. You know, if I had tens of millions in the bank, would I drop 250, 400K on a car? Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Of course I would.
Yeah. Right. Well, look, one of my oldest mentors, Ken, is I've known him for 23 years. He's 80 and he is worth quite a few million dollars. It's probably approaching double digits, more than double digits now in millions. And he still lives in a renovated three-bedroom weatherboard home. He drives a second-hand Audi that he's had for 6 years. His wife just sold her little Toyota four-wheel drive to get a second-hand Volvo. And he's had a little caravan down on the coast for the last 30 years, which he goes to each summer and plays banjo with his friends. And so he lives a very simple life in that regard, but he has no problem dropping $100,000 on a luxury cruise to Antarctica or to Tuscany.
I was going to ask, what's his motivation? What's made him, if it's not, because I see that, you know, if you take the Elon Musk example, who sold all of his property to finance his dream.
Yeah.
Is it the case that Ken is just enjoys the game? He enjoys the game of making money, enjoys the challenge. He likes keeping score with the balance books. Is that the way it works?
You know, I don't even think that motivates him much because, he's always been a very tempered, mild-mannered, reasonable man. In the 23 years I've known him, I've never once heard him raise his voice. I've never seen him get agitated. I haven't seen him, you know, and on the other side, I've never seen him, you know, busting with excitement about something either. He's very even-tempered. I think he does enjoy the game of business. He enjoys the personal relationships. He's very good at the soft skills, never been terribly good at the technical skills. I mean, he's owned a software company for years. He's the chairman now. He's retired as CEO. And I had to show him once how to put a photograph in an email because he didn't know how to do that, you know. So his area of expertise is the soft skills, and he and I get along famously because we love to talk philosophy and we love to talk about, you know, some of the woo-woo stuff. And we both like to talk about books that we've read and, you know, good wine and that sort of stuff. So I think he gets his pleasure from experiences, human experiences. And the business is probably just a way of him doing that, you know, and getting paid for it.
Yeah.
So I think that's what drives him.
Makes sense.
Now, in the intro, I mentioned that you were in my inbox every week for a year, and it was tremendously helpful, even though I fell off the radar a couple of times. But it really did give me the kick up the ass I needed because it's just one of those stupid things that when – I think some of it's fear of success or fear of finally completing something and then having it flop. But I really wanted to do this thing, and having you in my inbox was – I don't think it would have happened without it. Now, in that, it's called the Single Malt Mastermind. I don't know if you're going to re-release it or not. But each week you asked me three questions. The first one was, what have you done? Second one was, what are you going to do next week? And the third one was, anything else? And this is, again, this is very similar to the book you've written, very simple, very succinct, and it's very hard to say something succinctly. What was that saying? Was it Ralph Waldo Emerson said, I was going to write you a short letter, but I didn't have time? Something right. like that. So thanks to those questions and your feedback along the way, I was able to finally achieve that goal of mine of completing that course, something which I hoped might change lives. Now, I've consumed a lot of books over the years, a lot of courses, been a lot of seminars, all that sort of stuff. And I've noticed that almost all of them seem to want to make things more complicated than what they are. It seems to be a hidden ingredient that they want you to think things are difficult, so you must pay them a lot of money in order to get that little kernel of, you know, kernel of wisdom that's going to get you over the line. So you're the polar opposite of that. Your advice is logical and simple, and therefore, most importantly, it's doable. So why do you approach this stuff so differently?
Do you know the backstory to this book?
I don't. I know that there was another version published in 2011, and I wonder how much different it was to this, but tell me.
Yeah. No. Okay, so that's the backstory. So this book was written in large part back in 2010, mm-hmm. When I was exiting my recruitment company, when I was in the midst of what I thought was a nervous breakdown. Mm-hmm. And this wasn't something that happened overnight. It happened progressively. My relationship with my business partner was getting worse and worse. I was very much his apprentice. In as much as I was the muscle and he was the money, there was a balance of power in mm-hmm. that relationship. So although I was working for my own company, I was the owner. On paper, I had 50%, but it didn't feel like that. It just felt that I had a boss and the stakes were higher and there was no employment contract. and he was a prickly character. And so I, coupled with the fact that I wasn't enjoying the day-to-day work, although there were elements of it that I loved, which were the bits I retained, selling and training. I started as a creative outlet, which was missing, to write. And I wrote online, and I used to have a blog called How to Get a Grip at howtogetagrip.com. And it ended up being me writing in 5 to 10 minute windows of my day when I was feeling most like I needed to, you know, it's either going to smoke a packet of cigarettes or write something. Mm-hmm. And so I'd write something and they were very quick and punchy. And the tone of voice was addressed to me. It was get out of bed, get off your sorry ass, stop feeling sorry for yourself. You know, this is true. Stop self-sabotaging because I'm prone to it. And of course, you know, not everybody had a blog back in 2010. And so it started to get some traction. People started to read it. And one of those people was a publisher who said, we'd like to turn this into a book. And so we took some of the writing that was on the blog. Blog doesn't exist anymore. Took some of that writing, put it into the book. And it was released as How to Get a Grip in 2011 or 2012. So it was really written as a series of missives to myself. And that's why it didn't need backstory or explainers, because I already had it, right? I already had it. It's like, I was reading a book recently, which I think is quite a good book. I haven't finished it yet, but I probably will, called A Happy Pocket Full of Money. You might be familiar with it.
No, I haven't heard of it.
I don't know if I can recommend it yet, but it's been recommended to me by a number of people. And the first chapter, as far as I can work out, is an explanation of quantum mechanics. Quantum physics, which is fascinating from an intellectual point of view. But talk about, as a perfect example of what you just said, let's make sure that the reader has context, and let's make sure this context complicates things in order that we can then provide them with the solution. I used to use the same technique in timeshare sales, which is another job I used to do.
Yeah, I've read about that.
Never just bring them in and say, hi, guys. Here's a fantastic opportunity. Here's how much it costs, right? It wasn't enough. We had to spend 4 or 5 hours world building and creating problems that perhaps didn't exist, or highlighting problems that did exist that were buried. So we complicate in order to become the savior who can then.
Yeah.
So we used to end by saying, so you do agree that the way that you take vacations now is completely broken and causing you stress. And they said, yes, but they didn't believe that 2 hours previously.
Sounds very boiler room to me.
Well, it was. That was one of our training videos, no joke. You know, I was happy to get out of that environment. So the book was really written as a missive to myself, and I didn't need the backstory because it was to me. And of course, that resonated, because if you don't have to introduce complicated truths, you just switch the way of looking at things. And I think actually in my book, I don't think anybody reads the book and says, that's new. to me.
No, but that's what's so brilliant about it.
I boil it down to the ridiculous.
Yes.
I say in the early chapters, you know
this.
All of this.
Yes.
You've just perhaps forgotten or perhaps lost perspective. So it's a resetting of perspective, but I'd say there's nothing new. There's some, a couple of times I think you'll smile and you go, huh. And that's the boiling it down to the ridiculous. Like you're convinced that everybody thinks you look like an idiot because you just tripped up in the street. But yeah. Nobody thinks that. Everybody thinks, oh, no, is the poor guy okay?
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. I love the footnotes in it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think a cognitive behavioral therapist would nod their head. I've studied a little bit of cognitive behavioral coaching and have worked with a therapist myself who specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy. And a lot of it is echoed in my book, kind of unknowingly. Like there's a lot of common sense around that all or nothing thinking, overreacting to external stimuli, things that all of us are guilty of. Basically, the minute something happens externally, it runs through these neural mesh filters in our head and it becomes something which it isn't.
Yeah.
And that's really what I've addressed with the book. It's okay. Take life less seriously. You've probably got more capability in you to do things than you believe, because negative self-talk is a big deal, and start to take some responsibility for yourself.
You might remember that speech Steve Jobs gave at Stanford University, and he said that we can only join the dots looking back on our lives. It's pretty much impossible to join them ahead. And when you try and plan your life out, then, you know, life has a habit of getting in the way and they screw up with your plans. So I'm curious to know now, looking back, now that you've turned 40, now that you've reached the, not even the midway point, how did the earliest parts of your life, you know, going from being a street performer through to high-end corporate sales, how did that inform what you do today?
Now, certainly the lowest points tally with the best turnarounds. The pivots have always been good.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So making the decision, perhaps a more dogged and determined me would have stuck with this recruitment company.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'd have digestive issues and alcoholism and misery. And I'd be living in a gray country. I didn't see my youngest kid when he was born. You know, didn't see him. So I was working every single weekend. And so certainly flipping to that and then creating space in my life to, do something new was great, but also, I mean, that has led directly to where I am now, but also the choice of teacher. Like I chose Michael Port, who created Put Yourself Solid, to teach me how to be a business coach, because he had a system which he was selling. And so I bought it off him just to save the learning curve. And we ended up getting on very well. And he offered me opportunities and he made introductions and kind of raised my standing in the world, which meant I got the ear of people that I wouldn't have necessarily had the ear of. And it was through that very specific situation that, I'm now doing what I am today. In fact, Peter, I've gone back to Michael this year and made him an offer for Book Yourself Solid to run that organization now. So now I'm focusing almost exclusively on training the trainer. I'm licensing business coaches, and that's fantastic as well. So how did that happen? Well, that happened because I took 3 years off to dick around on my own. I did speaking, I did coaching programs, I did the Single Malt Mastermind. I had fun. I had real great 3 years until it got to summer last year. I was running a mastermind program for a fantastic group of business owners and something didn't quite feel right. So I took some time off, partly because I figured I'd been doing it for 10 years and I was due a holiday, which doesn't always get prioritized.
No.
But I just cleared my calendar for 3 months and it ended up becoming a lot longer than 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But that created the space for me to say, well, what do I need to replace it with? Because what I noticed during that time is that revenue dropped off a cliff. I salvaged it through relationships by the end of the year. And by relationships, you know, a few joint venture partnerships, a few appropriate offers to my friends' audiences and things like that. But I didn't want to be in that situation again. But it was only by creating that situation that I realized that. So that allowed me to go to Michael and say, hey, you've got a business that I want to buy. And so that wasn't on my radar 3 years ago. But I always enjoyed having a well-paid part-time job, which is what it was, you know, really. But yeah, because everything required me showing up. Even the even the digital products I sell are, you know, there's an element of customer service involved. Whereas now I've actually got a business with other people who can take care of the running of it when I'm not doing it, which is, and so you're right. You can't, but could I have foreseen that? Could I have said that's what's going to happen? No, it required that I build up other things. It required that I get tired of other things. Mm. Even starting the recruitment company, made me a business owner. And then as a business owner, I started reading business books, including Book Yourself Solid. And I got on the mailing list. Becoming a business owner meant I went to networking events. Going to networking events, these breakfast networking events, BNI, things like that, meant that I was exposed to a lot of business coaches and trainers who were, to my mind, substandard. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And I thought, crap, I do a better job of this every day inside of my company. Imagine what I could do outside of my company. So all of these things allow you to, or certainly all of these things allowed me to navigate the path. But could I tell what is 5 years from now? Absolutely no idea. Mm-hmm. Absolutely no idea. But that said, I don't have regrets, but I think I could have been a little bit more persistent with a few things in the past. Like, did I have to leave that recruitment company? Could I have trained up a general manager? And at the time, I was convinced I only had one route.
Yeah.
But I built it to some – the company's still running today. Neither of the original founders are involved. Mm-hmm. But could I have put somebody in place? When I closed down the Single Malt Mastermind, a few people asked me, can I take over the running of it? Mm-hmm. Do you want to pay me a salary and I will run it? And there's no reason I should have said no to those things other than brattishness, you know, or short-sightedness perhaps. So although there are no regrets, I think I probably could still be sitting on more previously built assets if I'd been a little bit more of a long-term thinker when it came to them. And that's now firmly in my mind now. Let's find a way to keep it working for everybody and not, you know, my exit doesn't have to mean the end of something.
Yeah, yeah. Look, over the last 10 years of going from having millions in real estate to having no real estate, and that was after working really, really hard to build that, I realized that investing well and securely over the long term so it can accumulate in the right asset types, safeguards against other failures like this. They can be siloed and they can be failures in their own right, but so long as the long game is taken care of in the background, and I'm talking about things like index funds, a couple of good quality real estate assets that have good capital growth and redevelopment potential where you can afford to service them. You know, you're not stretching yourself, those kinds of things. If you take care of that, then you can still experiment over here and you will still get rich eventually. You know, when you're older and you're a bit crustier, you'll have enough fuck off money. You know, so if you don't feel like doing stuff, you can say, that's all right, I've had enough.
Long-termism is a word that I've been using a lot as well recently. It's like, I work with startup coaches, like people who are beginning a coaching career now, as well as other professionals, but that's my large focus. And a lot of them are thinking very short-term. You have to think short-term if it's a survival instinct, but I guess it's easy to say after 20 years of self-employment, but it's less easy to say or see when you're just getting started. But these things, if you do the right things, if you lay the right foundations, if you day after day get, you know, like 1% in the right direction,
yep,
with some security and some safety and not spending all your money and things like that, there's a lot of joy in taking your time over things.
Yeah, yeah. Look, this is something I impress on my son, Tommy, who's 9 and have done for a long time now. He's got 2 bank accounts. He's got a fun account and he's got an investment account. The investment account, once that's got $5,000 in, this is only money that he earns or that he gets for Christmas presents from, you know, the oldies and stuff.
Yeah.
Once the investment account's got $5,000 in, then that gets converted to an index fund. And then the same principles will carry. Every time he gets any money, 20% of it goes into the fun account. He can, you know, blow that on Roblox or stupid crap, whatever he wants, Minecraft things. But the other 80% is going to accumulate in the background. It's going to compound. And I explained to him the other night what happens, you know, with money over a period of time and how it multiplies over and over. You know, you start, I gave him a few examples, but the classic one of you start, you know, I can give you $500,000 now, or I can give you 1 cent today and double it for 28 days. Which do you want? You know, and after 28 days, starting with a cent, you got well over $1 million. You know, and
I'd say five grand invested at the age of 9.
Oh, no, he doesn't have $5,000 yet.
Needs, right?
No, he's got 1,100. He's got 1,100 right. in his investment account. But mind you, he's already bought himself. He paid for more than half of his motorbike. He paid for more than half of his iMac because he's also now writing games. He's coding. He's such a nerd.
Fantastic.
It's awesome.
Fantastic. That's great.
He's a YouTuber now. So anyway, I just keep telling him and I tell my girls, look, if you just do this habit from an early age and you make it so that you don't have to think about it and you have a very simple plan, then you can still enjoy your money and you can change the percentages later. Like you start off, you know, 80-20. Later it can be 50-50, then 70-30, whatever. But you've got to have this habit of putting it away. You don't see it. You don't touch it. And then later on, that'll be your fuck off money. And then you're going to be rich regardless of whether you succeed as a YouTuber, as a hairdresser, as a makeup artist, as a doctor. Whether you succeed or fail at those, you're still going to get rich anyway. You know, it takes all the pressure off, takes the stress out of your head.
Right.
So, look, I wanted to ask you, why do you think it is – I'm going to have to skip some of these questions or else we're going to do a Mary Rogers podcast and go for 3 hours. But why do you think it is that it takes so many of us so long to work out what works for us? I mean, is it preconceived notions from our peers? Is it the media constantly feeding us short-term thinking and shiny syndrome? Is it our parents holding us back? Why does it take us kind of this long to our 40s or 50s to figure out what really works for us and what makes us happy?
I've been really interested in the idea of people who are products of their environment and people who manage to get out of being a product of their environment, because that's the kind of the choice that we don't make, right? Where we're born, the family we're born into, the socioeconomic status of the neighborhood that we live in, the health situation of our parents, the mental health situation of our parents. Mm. We don't get a choice of that, but we do see occasional outliers. One of my friends, Ashley Amberger, you might know her. She's a friend of Laura Belgrade's as well. She runs the Middle Finger Project.
Oh, yes, yes.
She's been a guest on my podcast and we talked about exactly this. And why is it that you, who were born in a trailer park outside of Philly, are now enjoying multiple residences in Costa Rica and Old Town Philadelphia and enjoying a, you know, one person, seven figure business with publishing contracts and armies of raving fans. Mm-hmm. And your next door neighbor is still living in the trailer park. And she thinks it's innate. And I don't have the answer to that. Yeah, I don't know, but I think we have to recognize that. I think we must always recognize that there is another way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And a sense of dissatisfaction can lead you to, especially if you haven't been trained in it or had your eyes open to it, can lead you to double down on misery, or it can inspire you to action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if there was another way of doing it? Back to cognitive behavioral thinking.
Yeah.
What if this wasn't true?
Oh, yes.
I'm trapped in this household. Well, what if that wasn't true? What if you went to live somewhere else? What if you had to get a part-time job in order to move out? What if you had, you know, this.
That's back to those what ifs again.
It's exactly that. What if it wasn't true is a question that I think we should all ask.
Yes.
It certainly helped me from a. I interviewed someone, this podcast hasn't gone live, but one of my recent guests on my podcast is an expert in innovation and creative thinking. And I said, what is innovation? And what is creative thinking? She's like, it's finding solutions to things that don't necessarily exist yet.
Okay.
Or finding a different way of doing things. And one of the primary things you have to do is say, this is true in our industry, and then flip it. Like she gave the example of cookies. She worked for a cookie firm. Said, well, tell us what's true about cookies. Cookies are round. Okay, so let's challenge that assumption. What if cookies weren't round? What if they were triangular? Could that be a selling point?
Mm.
And it turns out it could be a selling point.
It works for Doritos.
It's just exactly right. So looking at things from a different angle, looking at saying, if this is true, what if it wasn't true?
Mm-hmm.
What if this wasn't true? Has served me. And you know, I'd like to, and it's super complex. It's like anything, Peter. It's really easy to just say, right? Much more difficult to do when you have family members, emotions, expectations, guilt, baggage to deal with, right? Really is. And they're not everybody has family members who will keep them down, but plenty do. But
yeah.
I think plenty of people think they have family members. I think plenty of people think they have family members who will keep them down, but it's just they've never had that conversation. Hey, I'm thinking of going backpacking for a year. Well, that would be great. We would support you. Really?
Yeah.
You don't need me to take the dog for a walk every morning?
Mm.
No, we'll find a solution for that. Yeah, especially if we're nice people, putting other people first. We do a lot of worrying on behalf of other people.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't do that because they might or because they could possibly, which is great. We need to be, we need to have some level of empathy for civilized society to work. And where empathy breaks down, society starts to break down, as we're seeing in the United States at the moment. You know, selfishness doesn't serve in the long term, but I think a little bit of selfish assertiveness at the individual level isn't a bad thing.
Yes, and it often isn't met with the resistance that you expect.
Correct.
One of my old mentors, Charlie, I often talk about mentors, I sound like a crusty old sage, but one guy I used to read and listen to a fair bit was a fellow called Charlie Tremendous Jones. He was a big, loud caricature of an American motivational speaker with a double-breasted suit. He was 6'7", red tie that was too long, and he had a booming voice. And he would always give the same speech at his lectures and his seminars. But I loved him, and he wrote a book called Life is Tremendous. And he would often say, well, he would always say in his speeches that I have had a great many problems and some of them actually happened.
Right.
You know, and this is so true of all of us is, you know, Mary, who I was talking about before, who was on the podcast, I asked her, you know, we decided to do the Tim Ferriss thing and ask each other some of Tim Ferriss's questions out of Tool of Titans. And I asked her the billboard question, what would you put on a billboard? And she said, you can change your mind. And this is something that she specializes in is mentoring midlifers who are going through whatever crap they're going through. And often it just comes down to this thing is you can actually change your mind. You know, this thing that you thought was impossible that you were entrapped by, you can decide, as you said, to flip it on its head and say, well, what if I wasn't? Mm-hmm. What if I did do that thing? Would the world end? Would the people think ill of me? Would the people who matter think ill of me? You know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
I think we should get on to talking about your book. What do you reckon?
Sure thing. Let's do the book.
Okay. Now, the original title, I wanted to ask you about this. The original title, Get a Grip, published in 2011. How much different is this new book and why did you decide to rename it or to augment the title?
Right. So this is the story. I wrote the publisher of How to Get a Grip 2011 was John Blake. John Blake was a celebrity publisher in the UK, specialized in books that were stacked high and sold cheap in supermarket checkout lines. He was... Yeah, the first person to get an unauthorized biography of Princess Diana to market 3 days after her death. Former, right, exactly. So a commercial publisher, very commercially minded publisher. And the organization was bought, the publishing house was bought after my book was published 2011. It was bought by a company called Bonnier. I think maybe 3 or 4 years ago. Bonnier is one of the biggest publishing firms in the world. They have dozens, if not hundreds, of imprints all around the world. And I received an email out of the blue last August that said, Dear Matthew, we own your book. We are re-releasing it under the title Get a Fucking Grip. I hope this is okay with you. And that's the story.
Fair income. And I thought it was you being a clever marketing man.
No, well, it was them being clever marketing. And I know you mentioned earlier about the title.
Mark Manson,
Yeah, it was, you know, my book, How to Get a Grip, came out long before Mark's Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck book, which is a fantastic book, by the way.
It is brilliant.
It's not dissimilar to mine in idea, right? In idea, it's not dissimilar. And I do remember reading it and thinking, man, this is brilliant. The marketing play on this is brilliant. If only I'd put a swear word in my book in 2011.
10 years ago.
Right? So I was a little bit concerned that because there's been a whole glut of self-help books riding on the coattails of Mark's book, which have sweary titles.
Yes, I have noticed a proliferation.
Massive proliferation to the point where bookshops have sweary title sections.
Oh.
And so I didn't want to jump on the tail end of the bandwagon. I didn't want to look like my title was derivative, but ultimately it wasn't my decision. Mm. And they made a very good point at the publishing house because I raised this with them. They said, it's a genre now.
Okay.
It immediately tells the reader what they can expect. It's just a signaler. It's like, if you are in the market for Mark Manson's books and for other sweary books, you will be in the market for this. And so from a pure marketing point of view, I think it was great. And it led to an audiobook, which I was really proud of, which hadn't happened before. Mm-hmm. There were some minor rewrites. I made it a little bit more politically correct. There's some language that was that I used 10 years ago that I might not use today.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing racist or sexist,
just a bit more abrasive.
A little bit more abrasive that I think a 40-year-old me is. I'm glad I wrote it when I was 30 because I was swearier and angrier, mm-hmm. and therefore it had the punch that it wouldn't have today because I'm more mellow, right?
Yes, and you have to force it.
Yeah, and it would have felt forced. So there were some very minor rewrites. Just I think I cleaned up a couple of paragraphs. So I reread them. Like, even I don't know what I'm saying here. And then I did the audiobook, recorded that in December, which it was a real fun experience. And that exists now, which didn't exist before.
I'm going to have to listen to that. And you're doing the reading?
Yeah, I did the reading, yeah.
Did you ad-lib much or did you read it verbatim? Just curious.
No, I read it straight. And I asked about this. There were two schools of thoughts. The people that matter, the actual publishers, said, do what you want.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole group of authors, because we have a Facebook group, authors' secret Facebook group. Are you an author? You can say.
So I'm an author.
I was like, what's the deal? Because some of the best audiobooks I've ever heard, and I haven't heard many, have been the ones where they've added something mm-hmm. to the book. There's been an extra level of improvisation or question and answer or explanation or audio footnotes or something like that.
Yeah.
And a couple of people said, yeah, well, we tried to do this, but our publishers own the words. So it's up to them. They have to okay it, right? So they own the words. And my publisher said, actually, you own the words. We own the copyright on the final product. So you can do what you want. We'll edit in post-production. And there were a few instances where I just had to clean things up when I was reading it.
Yeah.
Which didn't get reflected in the final version of the book. But no, it's pretty much a straight reading.
Well, it's written in a conversational tone anyway,
Yeah.
I think you could read that verbatim and it would still come across great. I'm looking forward to having a listen to it. Seth Godin said that, a lot of people get writer's block, but nobody gets talker's block. And that book reads like it's you talking to us anyway.
Right.
That's also why it's so relatable. Now, I want to go on and explain a little bit more about why I think this book is so important, because we've touched around the edges of it, but I want to get a little bit specific if I could. And I've written a couple of notes here. And I want to start with a few years ago, I actually wrote a little book myself, and it chronicled what I'd learned about getting out of debt after my divorce left me with, no property. I had five, I ended up with nothing, and I ended up with 140 grand in debt. So I took on the residual debt and had nothing. I didn't even have a couch. My ex-in-laws actually gave me an old wicker couch to sit on. Now, I sent a copy of that book to one of my heroes, Stephen Pressfield. And he was incredibly gracious. As soon as he got the book, he read it because it's only, I think it was it 80 pages long or maybe 80 pages or less? No, I think it's less than that. I think it might only be about 50 pages long. It's quite thin anyway. But he read it and he wrote back to me almost immediately, like within a couple of days. And he gave me a very glowing report on the book. And he said that its accessibility was a big thing. He said a lot of books are laborious to read. And like Seth says, they don't need to be 200 pages long, a lot of them. They can convey the point in 20, but no one will buy that. But Stephen Pressfield reckoned that short, punchy books are the future. And he said, maybe they're even the present. And he said, this is the kind of book that he would like to write more of, So in my book, I offered simple, blunt, unapologetic advice. That's my style. And I wanted people to read it and think, shit, this is exactly the problem that I have. I need to pull my finger out and, get out of this mess that I'm in. Now, your book does exactly the same thing, but the difference is yours is extremely funny. It covers every area of our lives that matters. Mine was just talking about getting out of debt and overcoming this urge to want stuff all the time, physical stuff. I see your book as like a manual for how to live that anyone can follow. And for me personally, after I read it, I knew again, like you said, it's all stuff that we know, but we tend to forget it. And I knew again what to focus on and what to jettison. I relearned how to get stuff done and deal with others and take myself less seriously. And I had a much simpler and cleaner understanding of relationships and health and money and work and, all this other stuff. And then, like I said, a steak knife thrown in at the end, I got a collection of 8 quick wins at the end to send me on my way with a kiss on my forehead. So my personal copy of the book here is kind of gnarly now. It's got lots of scribbles in it and stuff, lots of I tend to mark things with a pen down the side in the margins where I want to, you know, go back and reread stuff. But if you don't mind, I want to read something in the preface that sets the whole thing up. Okay, I want to read this in the preface, and then we'll talk a little bit about it if we can. With the interference of the self-help industry, you've come to believe that the game of living is a lot more difficult than it actually is. You're now entirely convinced that just about anything is insurmountable without some kind of intervention from a system or a seminar or an expert or a book or a workshop or a religion. This book is an intervention, and it's the last one you'll ever need. It was easy to write because it's plain old vanilla rehashing of common sense, common knowledge, and absolute truths packaged up cunningly as a self-help guide. It is the most important book you'll ever read. Buy three copies. Nothing in these pages will surprise you, but a lot may delight you, and even more will have you nodding your head in recognition and saying, "Yes, I already knew that." Let me repeat, you already know that, but you've forgotten because of the noise. That is a brilliant segue into the rest of the book and the stuff that that you impart in it, and particularly the story that you have in the beginning about Benjamin and Sophia, the characters in that parable. I really like that. And I know people who are like that. Mm. What do these two people, Benjamin and Sophia, teach us in this story?
So the story of Benjamin and Sophia is a story about a poor runt of a litter kid who is down on his luck. He is employed or pretty much kept as a slave by a barbaric factory keeper, and he's the very epitome of a poor, miserable, luckless sod. And yet, well, we'll come to that. And then Sophia is the polar opposite of him. Sophia lives on a hill. She has Gucci bags and a trust fund, probably, and she probably doesn't work, but she has an allowance and a fantastic income, and she does lunches and she does shopping sprees and she takes private jets to beautiful locations. And one of them is happy and one of them isn't. Right? And, of course, it's Benjamin who manages to find some joy in his particular case, a collection of marbles, who dies the happiest young man in the world at the age of, you know, 15 from
typhoid breathing, or something, probably.
Yeah, something miserable, breathing fumes from the factory he works in. And Sophia, you know, despite all of her comforts and luxuries and benefits and privileges, is perpetually miserable and takes her own life.
Yes. It's so common, that story, and so many people are living that story now. They just haven't gotten to the death part, but they're living it now. You know, I read about a wealthy German industrialist, I think it was, many years ago. He was worth about 9 billion Deutschmarks decades ago, and there was a stock market crash and his wealth plummeted to 5 billion or something like that, and he threw himself in front of a train.
You know, there's no accounting for mental health. We know that, you know, mental health affects rich, poor. Depression affects people who have everything and also people who have nothing. And I think my point in the book is about how your happiness does not depend upon your circumstance. And definitely that the collection of Gucci handbags is not going to be any indicator about how satisfied you might feel.
It's not an accurate metric.
Yeah, no, I think it's not an accurate metric, and very cognizant of the fact that mental health issues can affect people indiscriminately. We should just be aware that the chances of our happiness is not in another thing.
Well, this leads beautifully into something else which really struck me in the book, and that is two topics that you cover very early: lowering expectations and knowing when to stop. Tell me more about those.
This is all or nothing thinking. You know, lowering expectations is you're probably doing okay, and a lot of the pressure you're feeling, which causes stress, which causes cancer, ultimately end of the trail, can be avoided by you letting yourself off the hook a little bit. Sometimes we are incredibly hard on ourselves. And sometimes that's the only source of hardness we have in our life. So not always, but very often, you know, can we let ourselves off the hook? Can we say, I'm satisfied with what I have done, what I have achieved, what I've done today, what I've done this week, what I've done this month. Running the Single Malt Mastermind, I saw people who were having fantastic weeks, week after week after week after week, have one dud week and write to me like it was the end of the world.
Yeah.
And I would say, dude, you know, zoom out a bit. Zoom out a bit. Be less hard on yourself. Look at everything you normally do. Look at everything that you've achieved. Look at how happy you are. Look at how wonderful your kids are. Look how much your family values you. Value yourself a bit more. And what was the other one?
The other one was knowing when to stop.
Yeah, the famous parable, you know, I can't remember. It's probably not a parable. It's probably a true story attributed to the wrong person. John meets Bob at a dinner party. Bob is incredibly wealthy industrialist, has billions of dollars in the bank. And John says, but I have something you will never have. And he says, what's that? He says, enough.
Oh, right? That's good.
So it reiterates exactly that point about Sophia. You know,
that's a powerful statement.
Right?
I love that.
What about saying I have enough?
Yeah.
Everything I need. I remember one of the colleagues I used to work with when I was doing a brief stint in human resources at the European Commission was...
That sounds kind of exotic almost.
Right. Well, no, but thank you. It did involve travel to exotic locations there. was a lady called Iris. She was German. Mm-hmm. And she was a secretary and... you know, it's quite a hierarchical organization, the European Commission. When I was there, it's probably changed since because it's been 20 years. When I was there, we used to have D-grade employees, C-grade employees, B-grade and A-grade. They were exactly what you think they are. D-grade were delivery men and janitorial staff and people who delivered the post. C-grade were secretarial administrative support. B-grade were assistants and A-grade were the executives. and there was a lot of talk in the coffee tables about what can we do to get promoted? How can we move up a grade? How can we climb the ladder? And Iris was like, we knew how much everybody earned. It was an open payment book. Many of us were young and ambitious. But Iris was like, I have such incredible wealth. We're like, what do you mean? You're a C grade. And she was like, I have a beautiful husband who loves me. I have beautiful children who loves me. I am so happy. She was religious, but I don't think that's necessary, but I think it helped. I'm not religious.
Neither am I.
Despite my upbringing, and probably because of my upbringing, I've rebelled quite strongly against religion. But I have read reports that there's a correlation between satisfaction and some belief in
something.
Something. This is God's plan for me. You know. But I have beautiful children. I am wealthy beyond belief, and that's always stuck with me. So she was she had enough, right? And she was genuinely very happy.
My mother. Well, I grew up in a place called Mount Martha, which is close to a beach down the coast on a little peninsula in the bottom of Australia. And we were five doors away from a golf course, which was in an elevated position looking out over the bay. It was beautiful. We walked the dogs there every night. I played there around the perimeter of that as a kid growing up, and it was wonderful. And during those years when we would walk the dogs together every night, we would go to the ninth green that was on the side closest to the view of the bay. And my mum would always say to me, look at this, Pete. We're millionaires. I mean, look at that. It's like this was created just for us to see it. And it's so true. You know, you only have to look around you and take inventory of all the stuff you have. I mean, even if you just want to compare the physical stuff that we have, like even just the stuff that's sitting there behind you, you know, 98% of the population of the world will never be able to afford what's sitting behind you. You know, the headphones on your head, the microphone in front of your face, they just will never be able to afford that stuff. You know, we're already winning. And like you said, you can continue to, you know, change the baseline as you progress, but I think it all comes down to being a satisfied striver. So, you know, these two points really resonated with me, and they weren't a cop-out in my mind of, oh, well, it's okay to give up and just say, that's it, I'm going to stop now, I'm going to be a bum. It's not that at all, and the kind of person who buys this book isn't looking for that message. I think if you've got a couple of brain cells still communicating with each other, you look at this and you think, this allows me to take a breath and go, all right, take stock of what I have. I don't have to have a private jet. I used to be so ambitious and so driven that I had to have a private jet, you know, and I even rented a private jet to propose to my second wife like an idiot. I can't believe I did that just to impress her, you know. I didn't even get, you know, to join the Mile High Club, so it was wasted.
Man.
And it's fine to step back and go, I don't really need that private jet and I don't really need to drive a Bentley and I'm actually really happy to have what I have. But now that I've established that I'm very happy, I think I'm going to strive for this next level because of who I'll become right. as I strive for that because right. I'm already happy. Yeah, absolutely I love right. that. I love that in your book because everything that I read, almost everything I read, you know, is so – it's all about being the best you, being the fastest, being the greatest, being the best at everything. And when do you ever actually stop and say, shit, I've done really well. I'm really, really happy with this. This is – I don't know if you've heard of the minimalists, Joshua Fields Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus. They talk a lot about doing away with goals. And I kind of relate to this Joshua especially talking about he lives a goalless life now. He said, I'm only concerned with the direction that I'm going and the life that I'm leading and the relationships I'm having along the way. I'm interested in the direction that I'm going. But if I set a goal for, say, 2 years out that I want to have X revenue or I want to have X number of book sales or I want this documentary to be on these networks or whatever, all I'm doing is postponing my happiness until those happen. And they may not happen. And even if they do happen, I waited until then to be happy and then bang, it's off, it's over and I've got to find the next one.
Yeah, a lot of truth in that. And also, you know, it can, depending on the kind of personality you are and what kind of structure you need in your life, it can prevent you from exploring opportunities that might be better.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Know? Everything has a flip side, doesn't it?
Right.
Yes. So something else that you mentioned in this book also, which was very, very, very profound, and I wonder if you could talk about it, is adopting the mindset of a six-year-old. What do you mean by that?
This is particularly in the UK, I think less in the US, not sure about Australia, but we tend to give an awful lot of, at least in my experience, my background, we don't do things because we worry a lot about what others will think, what others will do, or because if you had an upbringing like mine, you never take the last cookie on the plate and you never take the first cookie on the plate until somebody asks you if you want a cookie, right?
Yep.
Whereas when you're six, you're just a little bit more self-centered. And it's difficult to recommend self-centeredness without sounding narcissistic mm-hmm. or without sounding like I'm encouraging narcissism. But I think assertiveness, this is a call to be more assertive. That's what it is. When you're six, you make it quite clear what you want, how you're feeling, whether you're tired, whether you're hungry. You are looking out for your primal needs. And it's okay. You'll let your parents probably eventually tell you, no, you can't have another bag of candy. But you certainly won't be shy to ask for it. And I think we do a lot of suffocating of our desires as we get older. We definitely do it. Oh, if only that girl would go for dinner with me. If only that guy would answer my text messages. What if you asked her to go for dinner? What's the worst that could happen? I hope that's something I said in the book. I can't remember everything because I certainly say it a lot today. What's the worst that could happen if you were to ask this girl out for dinner, if you were to ask this guy if you can exchange numbers, if you were to tell your boss, hey, I'd like a raise, because that's what a six-year-old would do.
Yeah.
Because the worst that can happen is you get smacked on your bum and you get sent to bed early.
Yeah, that's right. And not even that's going to happen when you're 43.
Exactly. Unless that's what you're asking for, right?
Yeah, it depends which establishment you're working in.
Yeah, right. Right.
Okay, so this leads me on to another question. Why isn't self-confident, the term self-confident, a good way to describe how I feel about myself or how I perceive myself? Can you remember what you wrote about that?
This sounds, yeah, I wrote this 10 years ago. I did reread it. I reread it and rewrote it back in December. Yeah, confidence is, we unless we lack empathy and unless we have some kind of borderline sociopathy, a lot of our self-worth comes from other people,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you are surrounded by people who tell you you're doing good or you're a good guy or he's lovely, you know, at the beginning of this intro, I may have woken up this morning, Monday morning, wanted to stay in bed, maybe had a rough weekend, maybe didn't, maybe had a great weekend, but just feeling neutral.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. When I come to the office, I'm like, okay, this is me. I'm with me all the time. I'm in my office on my own all the time. I know me. I have a clear understanding of me. And then, and so my, if we were to say my measure of myself was neutral,
Yep.
My self-confidence was neutral. Do I feel like I could do anything? No, I just feel like I've got out of bed, I've come into the office. I'm not feeling one way or another.
Yeah.
I don't have a morning motivation routine. I don't have a goal in my mind today that has fired me up. But the minute we started this conversation and you gave me that phenomenal intro, I was like, you raised my vibrations. I was like, holy crap, I've done a lot with my
life.
I've
got a remote control here.
Right. I'm worth something, right? And so what we should always, because our idea of self-confidence comes from, in large part, how other people treat us. And because our confidence will be knocked if we're in an abusive relationship. That's the first thing to go, right?
Yeah, of course.
So if we are surrounding ourselves with the right people, and if we stop mind reading, which is another cognitive behavioral diagnostic, we don't know what other people are thinking about us.
No.
So let's assume the best.
Yes.
Let's just assume they think we're awesome. Why wouldn't they? roughly what I said in the book? I hope
yes, absolutely.
Consistent over the last decade or so.
And the irony is, you know, one of my favorite sayings is from another guy from Malta, and I tried and tried and tried to remember his name, but the last time I saw him was about 20 years ago. And this guy from Malta said to me, "What you think of me is none of my business." And I love that. And I've carried that with me ever since. And I tell my kids this, look, what anyone else thinks of you, whether it's a bad comment on Instagram or someone who's trashing you on YouTube, what they think of you is none of your business. You don't know all of the crap that's gone on in their life that led up to this point. You know, a troll may have been abused as a kid. He could have been taken off the breast too young. He could, you know, have a sister that's a punk rocker and, you know, has guys coming over and playing thrash metal every night. And he's irritable and he's, you know, got Asperger's. You don't know. You know, so what he thinks of you is really none of your business. Don't worry about it. You know, move on.
Right.
Yeah.
And most of the time we're wrong about what other people think.
That's right.
We normally think the worst. It's a defense mechanism. Strangers are viewed as somebody to be suspicious of until they've earned their worth. But mostly strangers are harmless or benign.
Yeah, yeah. We should be more like dogs that go around and sniff each other first and go, it's okay. We're fine.
Absolutely right. I would encourage that. Butt sniffing.
Yeah.
Maybe we should. Yeah. Maybe. I think there's a motivational seminar in there.
I'm going to see if buttsniffing.com has taken.
You know it is.
It definitely is. Towards the end of the book, you mentioned something which I've railed against for a very long time. And probably not that long, actually. It's really only, I think, since when I turned 40. And I'll be interested to know in time how this is affecting you turning 40. But when I turned 40, I decided, that's it. I'm going to say no to stuff I don't want to do and I'm not going to explain why. That was my thing. That was my mantra for turning 40. And I felt wonderful when I made that decision. Now that I'm 52, I'm starting to have even more – I'm starting to pare things down even more and get a lot simpler in my thinking. And because I've got teenage daughters and I've got a son now who is growing very rapidly, such a smart kid, I find myself dispensing advice to them all the time, whether they listen to it or not, I don't know. But one of them here, which you mentioned, which I love, is this idea that you reckon is crap and I do too, is that you can do anything. And I keep telling my kids, you can't do anything. I mean, I can't be a basketball player. Because I'm, you know, 5.5 foot and I'm, you know, 95 kilos. I've got no chance. So you can't be anything. You can't do anything. So what are your thoughts on this? And
well, firstly, it doesn't stop you playing basketball.
No.
Right? You may never be, but if you love playing basketball.
I should have said I can't compete.
Yeah, go play every day.
Mm.
Why, you know, I would actively encourage you to do that every day. I'd also say to manage your expectations, which is, you know, that comes with self-knowledge and comes with self-worth. And saying no to things, there's a really important caveat around that. Like you don't have to agree to do things. You certainly don't have to agree to do things that make you feel uncomfortable. And you don't have to agree to do things that you don't want to do. You know, do you want to come to this party? Listen, my mental health, my physical health requires that I don't come to the party. So I'm going to pass on that. Do you want another drink? Right? But the important thing is you have to think long-term as well. Yes, you're not obliged to say yes. But what if satisfying, pleasing, giving a favor to, reciprocating, being generous with the person who invites you is more important than your desire for a night in. Mm-hmm. Right. So I don't think you should say no indiscriminately. I think you should not be afraid of saying no.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy for us as middle-aged white men to say that. Exercise agency, you know, women and others are probably saying, we've been trying to say no for our entire lives, but nobody listens, right?
Mm.
But it's okay to say, and also not to explain. You don't have to offer explanations. I get this a lot with people who pitch me or cold pitch me or try to sell me things or send me proposals. And I say, thanks very much for the proposal, I'm not interested. And they write back, say, would you mind telling me why not? I'm like, no.
No.
I don't feel I have to respond to every email nowadays. I get an email going, that's nice. But I didn't enter into a contract with that person to reply to their email. And I think that's really important because the demands on our time and the demands on our attention are getting greater and greater and greater with the amount of stimulus that we have, the amount of media, the amount of ways that we can be contacted.
The number of channels.
Entertainment options, the number of channels. You know, I've been... Occasionally, when I'm behind on replies, my default response now is, sorry, too many inboxes. Because it's true. Right? There's just too many inboxes. And I go, oh, I'll get to that in a minute. And then it's a week later. So it's okay to selfishly guard your time, but don't think too short term when it comes to that. You know, if you still want your wife to sleep with you, you know, maybe you're going to have to do a little bit of quid pro quo and look out for other people along the way. But otherwise, you've got to feel happy to say no.
Yes. And tell me, why should I evacuate my mind bowels?
Because your mind is full of shit.
That's the answer I was looking for.
There we go. Too much mental mess we've accumulated over the years. Meditation is not mentioned in the book. 40-year-old me would encourage that. Because I've yet to meet a smart, balanced, hugely successful person who doesn't have some form of meditative practice, even if that is going off grid for 1 week every 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't have to be the morning
facing
routine. It could be playing badminton or rock climbing or something, but anything which just allows you to clear out the neural pathways, because we spend so much time accumulating mess. It fogs our thinking and it colors our judgments in a bad way. You know, we are full of opinions. What was it? The quote you gave, Mr. Tremendous, worrying about things that have never happened and will never happen. So we've got a purge. We've got a purge. And sometimes that can come through therapy. Sometimes that can come through talking. Sometimes that can come through going for a swim. But, you know, slow brain doesn't help anybody, and it certainly doesn't help your mental health. It really doesn't help your mental health. So find some way, especially if negative self-talk is getting you down. You know, therapy is cheap and easy, and I'd strongly recommend talking if you're having too many conversations in your own head. So anyway, if you feel that you've got a burden going on in your brain, any effective way of relieving that, probably I encourage the use of alcohol as a social lubricant.
Yes, I know you do. This is my son, Tommy.
Hey, Tommy, nice to meet you. But anything that probably doesn't...
No.
All right, piss off. Do you need anything?
Yeah, open this.
Oh, okay. That is the one skill that I will retain in this household is opening things that are difficult to open.
There we go.
There you go, Sonny.
Yeah.
I told him he's always welcome to come up and interrupt me because he's cute.
I agree. Well, good choice. So I encourage the use of alcohol as a social lubricant, but it might not be the best thing for clearing the brain frog on a regular basis.
You made a really good point there, and I think a lot of people forget this because there is so much talk about morning routines and stuff, and meditation doesn't have to be sitting still and closing your eyes and listening to Deuter. It can be... I find one of the most meditative things for me is to get in my sports car and go for a blast or on a motorbike, because you're only concentrating on the task at hand and your brain can't think of other crap, you know, and that's a form of meditation for me.
When I wrote the book, cell phones weren't such a big deal as they are 10 years later. They certainly weren't little multimedia devices that they are today. But I actively encourage, you know, leaving them at the front door, leaving them in your bag when you go to restaurants, definitely when meeting friends. Any opportunity you can to put them down, I would do that. I think they're real. I think they're a real sickness. I still see kids. I don't worry too much about kids. I don't want to sound like a grandparent who says, back in my day, we used to talk to each other. I still see kids talking to each other. Teenagers have still got hormones.
Yeah.
They're still being physical with each other in the swimming clubs here in Malta. And that's good. You know, that's reassuring. And now they've got another way of doing it. I think the danger is when it just keeps feeding that brain with stuff, you know. My mother, who is 72 years old, recently got a smartphone, and she's worried. She said, I'm not reading books anymore. Because the default is to, let me just check in on, and that's something she misses. And I would argue, probably till I'm blue in the face, that, you know, reading a book a week or every month is good for you.
Yep, I would too.
Generally. And if it's important to you and you find you're doing less of it, please unplug, you know, turn off your phone. It's okay. Get rid of your TV. That's less of an issue nowadays. I don't know anybody who doesn't. I think there's less mindless television watching there used to be 15 years ago.
But there's also a lot more choice than there was. I mean, we had three channels when I was a kid. That was it.
Yeah, likewise. And we used to have a television which was black and white, and it had a knob that you had to turn.
You had to get up and change it, yeah.
Yeah. But there was a lot of mindless television watching. That's been replaced by mindless scrolling and surfing now.
Yes.
But now if you want to watch TV, you're typically making a proactive choice. And I'm a massive fan of the arts. I've got a lot of value and thought provocation through well-made TV shows now. Mm-hmm. But any form of brain clearing is critical. James Shramko, who you might know.
Yes. James Shramko, where do I know that?
Based out of Sydney. He's based in Manly. And he runs superfastbusiness.com, and he runs the Superfast Business event, which I've spoken at in the past.
Okay.
His life changed completely when he took up surfing. He moved to
I read a book of his recently.
Yeah, work less, earn more.
With the yellow and blue cover,
brilliant,
I think.
Brilliant guy.
I love that book.
He physically changed, his business changed, his face changed, his outlook changed, his relationship status changed when he started going surfing for 45 minutes a day.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that was a very good book.
You just get out of your brain. You purge all the crap that's in your head in whatever way suits you. A friend of mine loves rock climbing. Says you can't think about anything else.
Yeah.
You have to think about where your hand is going. You don't get the luxury of daydreaming because that's when you fall off.
Yeah.
So there's different ways of doing it, whatever suits you. I walk the dog, and I find that's a useful reset. Doesn't always get me out of my brain because it's a good opportunity for overthinking, right?
Yeah.
But if there's something you can do, so a change of state, a change of environment, and some, I think I would definitely recommend talking therapy for a lot of people. I think that can only help.
Funny you should say that. Mary said she talks to herself all day long, and she finds it tremendously helpful. And I told her about a habit that I have when I have a difficult nut to crack, that I will get in my car, and I've done this for 15-odd years. I'll get in the car with the voice recorder. It used to be a little Sony thing. Now it's my phone. And I will drive, and while I'm enjoying the act of driving, I will brain dump into my phone like I'm chatting to you, like you're sitting next to me, and say, okay, I've got this problem. I'm thinking maybe I could do this and maybe I could do that, but then this person said that, da-da-da, and I'll just brain dump it out. I'll empty my mind bowels, you know, into my phone. And it's oftentimes it's just the act of doing that which is enormously restorative rather than the substance of what got recorded on my phone. Sometimes it's useful, and I actually use it to string together some useful stuff that I can – you know, solve a problem with, but oftentimes it's just the therapeutic element of it.
Yeah, and I've yet to meet a therapist who doesn't recommend some form of delivery for your internal monologue, whether that's journaling onto a piece of paper or recording your thoughts, as you said, or talking to another person. The important thing is that we actually provide an exit route, you know, from our mouth or from our finger onto the page, because that allows you, you know, even sleep therapists say, keep a notebook by your bed, because the thoughts, once they're recorded outside of your brain will feel more free to let them go. So if you're being kept awake at night by inner monologues, writing down what you're thinking is a great way of helping you with your sleep.
Yeah, I found that so helpful over the years. When I was planning to split up with my ex-wife and was still vacillating over how it was all going to play out, And I took 3 days off and went to my dad's house up in the mountains. And I talked through it with him. And I sat down there with a piece of paper. And this was the discussion around custody of the two girls, because I spent far more time with them than what she did. You know, I took them to school every day. I picked them up. I played with them. I took them away on weekends and stuff. So I was very, very close to my daughters, still are. And by getting all of this swirling mess of anxiety out of my head onto paper and putting it into pros and cons, I immediately felt a sense of calm after that was over. And I had conclusive backing for the decision that I was going to make. And
right.
Often this is the only way to get the noise out of your head. Like you said, it has to come out somewhere. You need a valve that you've got to release, whether it's written, spoken, whatever, singing maybe.
Absolutely. Or talking to friends. You don't need to, you know, you find the right friend who's happy to listen to you.
Yeah. And you lubricate the conversation with some good alcohol. And
you know, some of my most meaningful relationships has been forged over one too many drinks, because it breaks down the barriers.
It does.
And I'm not encouraging alcoholism. But I'm very grateful for the role that it's played in my life, because as a pent up male British, stiff upper lipped.
Yes.
But sharing emotions doesn't come easily, but I'm always grateful when I have done mostly.
Yeah. Well, I'm half German, so we're the same.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Germans don't like to do that either. Yeah. Look, I found it is, well, I figure that once a person's had a couple of drinks where they're lubricated sufficiently to drop their guard, that reveals the real them. They either become very talkative, very emotional or aggressive, you know, or affectionate, or they just become, you know, lovely people to be around. And I think it's a bit like when people win a lot of money. I don't think it changes them. I think it reveals them.
I don't know if that's true, but I'm not disagreeing with you. I just don't know if that's true. I have no idea.
Well, I reckon that I've known some people who've won big money. And I think that if you're a decent person who donates your time or your money to charity, and who wants to do some good in the world, then when you have a big win, you're going to just do more of it. You're going to be able to leverage that to do more good. If you're a narcissistic prick, well, then you're probably going to go and get a facelift and buy yourself a Bentley and hang around strip clubs all the time, you know?
Right.
So taking ourselves less seriously is one of the big unlocks to happiness. So I need to ask you, when did you last dance naked and make yourself messy?
Oh, man. So in the middle of the book, there are some specific recommendations for how to take yourself less seriously, including dancing naked and wearing a costume, walking in the street, singing in public. And yeah, I'm a huge fan of nudity, but I live in the Mediterranean where it's warm. Like today it's 38 degrees where I am. So
being naked is normal.
At home. Being naked is normal in our household, so I actively encourage that. My kid, who is – I've got two boys. My 10-year-old is on the autism spectrum, and sensory processing disorder is one of his diagnoses, which means he doesn't really like the feeling of clothes against his skin. So his default is naked. So he's normalized it for us. So,
good stuff.
We're a little nudist colony in our house.
Wonderful. On the subject of how to treat people – you offer a wonderful twist on the common saying, live today as if it were your last. Do you remember what that was?
Yeah. Treat everybody else as if it was their last day on earth. So we've all heard stories and perhaps experienced these stories ourselves, where our final meeting with somebody before they moved country, left house, split up with us, died, whatever that might be, was less than satisfactory. Mm-hmm. I wish we'd left on better terms.
Yep.
If I'd known that I was never going to see him again, I would have told him how much I loved him. Well, doesn't that tell us what we should tell people every single time we see them? Because we don't know if we're ever going to see them again. So if we love them, we should tell them. If we're fond of them, we should tell them. If we want to give them a hug and they're happy to get a hug, we should give them a hug. Mm. You know, that the reverse doesn't play out. I would have told him what an asshole he was if I knew I only had one chance. I think that doesn't do any good to the world. Just don't spend any more time with that person. You know, I think when a lot of people are looking for closure, it's incredibly unnecessary in most cases. The closure isn't going to come from something external. It's going to come from internal. I am at peace with this rather than I need to tell them. No, you know, I could do a lot more harm than good. I read a story in the papers like this week, maybe even this weekend, about somebody who showed up at a couple's front door and said, "Hi, I'm a woman. I'm about to get married. I have to let you know, because I need closure, that I had an affair with your husband 15 years ago." Right? What a selfish act. Anyway, it ended in death because
bloody hell.
somebody killed somebody else. But this was, you know, talk about not poking the sleeping bear. What a selfish act. So many times I see people say we need closure. It's more about an unburdening of themselves or, you know, guilt. Guilt shared is not alleviated, right? I have to tell you this. You know, I truly believe don't ask, don't tell is often the best policy.
Yeah. No, guilt shared is just guilt multiplied by anger and retaliation.
Right. So, you should treat, however, you should be treating people like it's their last day on earth. How would you treat this person if you knew you were never going to see them again? You know, don't go to bed. If you are in a good relationship, or even if you're not, maybe you could be in a better relationship by not going to bed on an argument. Mm. You know, always give your kids, always kiss your kids goodnight, even if you've had a shitty day with them.
I agree with that. One thing I'll say that is brilliant about my marriage with wife number three, and three is my lucky number. I've got three kids, I've had three wives, and I plan to keep it at three. Is we almost never argue. And if we do disagree about something, we resolve it as quickly as possible because we too recognize that it's a cancer, a physical cancer in the body when you go to bed fuming about the other person. Yeah. It just, it's like they say, you know, God, I can't remember. I was going to say something wise. Now I can't remember. Oh, yeah, that's right. You don't get ulcers from what you eat, you get them from what's eating you.
Yeah. I'm sure that's true. Yeah.
All right. I want to ask you a couple of fluffy questions before we close off. And thanks for giving me so much of your time. So tell me, describe the environment. I mean, you live in an exotic place. Malta sounds delightful. Everybody walking around naked, 38 degrees, you know, mm-hmm. hardly any neighbors.
It's exactly what it's like.
Mm. What more could you want? But tell me, what is the environment where you feel most inspired, where new ideas tend to bubble up? Where are you when they come?
Surrounded by other people who are doing creative things and right. doing big things. So sitting in a room, whether that room is in Amsterdam or London or Miami or Malta, with other people who are on a similar journey to me or have complementary experience and spitballing that stuff. It's the other people, not the environment.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've always been thinking about when I ask this question about the physical environment where they are, and I have a couple that I particularly like. Being in the car is one of them. But it's true, the most energizing and exciting and inspiring experiences have, when I think about it, been when I've been with people like that, big thinkers and people who do stuff, you know, creative people who do stuff. That's always very, very invigorating. So looking back over your life so far, and you're only still a young'un, in fact, you're nowhere near middle age because you've only been a grown-up for, 18 years. Hang on, 22 years. You've only been a grown-up for 22 years. So you're nowhere near middle-aged yet. I only realized that a few years ago for myself. But looking back over your life so far, what are a couple of things that you used to care about that just aren't important to you anymore now that you're old and wise?
What I wear.
Mm-hmm.
I like to present well, but I used to get deeply excited by going shopping for Italian suits and handmade leather shoes. And I even flew to Italy and Hong Kong once just to go shopping. And I just,
wow.
I just don't care anymore. And I think part of that is because I'm now living in a Mediterranean country where
everybody's naked.
A linen shirt, honestly, and a pair of flip-flops or thongs, as you call them, is frankly the single most comfortable thing most of the year round. If I moved back to London or if I went to live in Milan, I hope that I would pick up on that again soon, but I don't care. I'm moving more towards, you spoke about the minimalists earlier on, I'm moving more towards a setup where I wanted to have all the gear, and now I haven't replaced my laptop since the kids smashed it. You know, could I justify one? For sure. Do I need one? Nah. I'm looking more for the the essentials, less stuff. I used to be very house proud, not house proud precious, but house proud. I had a real delight for living in an environment which was well designed, which had carefully considered furniture and decor. And my 6-year-old and my 10-year-old boy have put the dampers on that. So I look forward to becoming. And now I proactively don't care. You know, because they will break things and they will draw on the walls and they will tear down curtains and they will scratch. And they will. They just will. It's guaranteed. So I no longer have proactively decided not to invest any energy in that area of my life. And I look forward once again to the day when I can. Perhaps there'll be a bachelor pad up the road that I can escape to, which will have an unsoiled piece of furniture at some stage in my future. But that's not so important anymore. Yeah, I mean those are the obvious ones that spring to mind. I'd like to say I've come on something. I no longer care what people think, but that isn't true. I do care what people think, and I also care what people think about me. Probably not to the extent that I used to, because it's less important. Because I recognise I am more self-sufficient than I used to think I was, and more resilient. But no, those are the big ones. They're kind of environmental.
Yeah,
what I wear. Where I live.
So on the flip side then, what matters a lot to you now that you never even really considered, say, 20 years ago?
My health.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, I was indestructible.
Mm. Me too.
Age 40, not feeling so indestructible anymore. You know, needs a little bit of maintenance. So there's a lot of swimming. There's a gym membership. There's considerations around what goes in my body. I'm not saying... Like, I don't think anybody would be writing any books on how to live healthily, but I now think about that. And in the past, I didn't think about it. You know, the fridge is well stocked. Used to be well stocked with booze. Now it's well stocked with nutrition dense vegetables. and just, you know, sounds like a cliche, but the ride that is parenthood, I'm coming up to a decade of it now.
Yeah.
And or over a decade, and that just it's just a reframe of everything.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
I never thought I could look a neighbor in the eyes and tell them to fuck right off, but I could now because there's you know, it's the daddy bear instinct, right? If there is some danger or nuisance or inconvenience to these little humans that I'm stuck with, whether I want it or not, I find reserves of energy and reserves of passion that I didn't know I had.
Yeah. You know, I really struggle to understand how a person can go through their whole life and not experience being responsible for at least one kid, because it does reframe everything, and mostly in a much better way. My last question here for you, or my second last question, the last one is semi-superficial, but I'll be interested to know what your answer is to this one. If you knew you had a decade left to live, what legacy would you like to leave behind? What will your kids and your grandkids consider to be your dent in the universe?
I'm not sure I've thought about this before, not at any level. But if I look at my dad, my dad has not published anything. He is not well known by any metric, really. I think he'd be happy to acknowledge that. He's not the founder of anything. He's not an employer. He's not done anything that's been reported in the record books or the newspapers. But his legacy is massive on me and everybody that he's met in his life, because he's treated them well and he's shown them a lot of love, and he's been a decent human being. And I'd be satisfied with that. Mm-hmm. I really would. You know, I have no desire to touch a million people, as some of our colleagues will boast about on Facebook. You know, impact is important to me in as much as I want people to be positively impacted through their experience with me, but not at any cost. The neighbors still get told to fuck right off if their music is disturbing my kids' sleep.
Right? I've done exactly the same thing.
Right?
Yes.
So that's enough for me. Mm-hmm. You know, leave the world a better place. Yeah, locally. Yes. You know, if I walk into a coffee shop and I don't take the opportunity to greet and make smile the barista who's on the other side of the counter, I'd say that's not my finest moment.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I'm feeling shitty, I will smile and say, how are you? And, you know, that's I think that's my duty to the world, to make sure that I leave a little trail of, that was all right. I had a positive experience. I'm glad, not with everybody, but with most people. That's the extent of my legacy. You know, leave my kids with an idea of a decent role model for most things.
Mm-hmm.
In acknowledging that they fuck you up, your mum and dad, and we always are going to pass down to them some unrecognized failings and issues and weaknesses that we have, and they will be a product of their environment and the environment that we have in part created and in part inherited. I don't give a lot of thought to changing the world.
Mm-hmm.
I give a lot of thought to affecting the people who are in my immediate life.
That is a very good answer, and it was the answer that I expected. Not quite so as eloquent as you've put it, but I had a feeling that your dent in the universe was going to be anchored in your kids and in leaving your part of the world a little bit better. So I think I know you rather well now.
There we go.
I can read your mind. Well, this has been so much better than I expected, actually, and I had high hopes.
Well, I had high hopes.
I didn't lower my expectations prior to this conversation. I knew that I was going to be speaking to a very smart, very funny, and very intelligent man, and I was not at all disappointed. And I've really enjoyed this conversation. I hope we get to do another one sometime.
I look forward to it. You have left this corner of the world better than you found it. So thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate
Peter.
That.
I appreciate that.
So tell me, where can we find more about you? Because a lot more people, I think, need to know about Matthew Kimberley. Even though you don't want to touch millions, I think a lot of people, millions, in fact, could benefit just from reading this book, even reading some of your web pages, which are a delight in themselves.
Well, thank you very much. I would recommend going to matthewkimberley.com and entering your email address into any of the available boxes, because that's where I'm doing most of my correspondence. I'm not doing an enormous amount of correspondence at the moment, but I'm. If we're going to be corresponding, it's by email.
Mm-hmm.
Don't follow me on the socials unless you... don't follow me on the socials if you want to be updated on the regular, because I'm very bad at the social media side of things.
Me
so,
too.
So matthewkimberley.com is where all the future opportunities lie.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I'm really glad I found you. If I can attribute anything to Laura, it is the fact that she introduced me to you, and I'm very grateful for that. And I genuinely hope that we get to chat again sometime in the future and not too far into the future. I'd love to have you back on the show sometime. When you're
writing. And a big shout out to Laura as well. Laura's a fantastic human being. And,
she is.
Very grateful.
She's awesome.
For that.
Thanks again, Matthew.
All right, my friend. Take care. Thank you, Peter. Thank you very much for having me.
No worries, mate. Bye-bye. And that wraps up this episode. Well, what a delight that man is. Now, if you'd like a free copy of Matthew's book, Get a Fucking Grip, I promise you it'll be one of the best books you've ever read. And you too will feel compelled to purchase additional copies and give them to those you love, especially your kids. So to score one of three copies, just write to me and tell me three things. What you learned from this episode, what habit or belief you'd like to change, and what it is you're struggling with that you hope Matthew's book might help you with. Write to me at peter@officeanywhere.co and make sure that you leave your mailing address as well. I'll pick three winners within the next fortnight and announce them on the show, plus I'll email you and let you know that you've won. I won't disclose your answers on the show if you prefer me not to, so make sure you let me know if that's the case. For this episode's show notes, go to officeanywhere.co/113. And while you're there, jump on over to matthewkimberley.com and make sure you get a copy of this fabulous life-changing book. I mean, even if you win a copy from me, it won't hurt for you to have another one to give to somebody. As I said earlier, I'm a voracious reader and this book stands up to the best of them. All right, that's it for this week. Until we chat again, here's to living on purpose. Catch you then. Bye-bye.